Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be speaking with Evan Davids. Today I'm speaking with author Evan Davids. Evan has written a book entitled Christianity No Longer Makes Sense. We talk about several topics, including the Christian narrative, the fall, evolution, biblical literalism, why there is something rather than nothing, Christianity and abortion, hell, and a few other topics. I'm still working out the audio for having conversations over the internet, so thanks for bearing with the lower quality while that's all being figured out. I really enjoyed the conversation we had, so let's get to it. All right, I'm here with Evan Davids. Evan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So you have written this book, Christianity No Longer Makes Sense, but you don't necessarily think of yourself as an atheist, which we can get to, because I think I'm with you on a lot of it, and yet we seem to come to slightly differing conclusions. But I really like the approach to the book because it sort of looks at the narrative that Christianity is trying to sell more so than any like individual argument, you know, like the fine-tuning argument or something like that.
Yeah, I tried to find sort of low-hanging fruit, big stuff that sort of cuts to the center of the worldview. You know, there's a lot of things to latch onto and argue about, but the three main things I looked at, I felt were like major pressure points, at least for me when I was trying to put together a coherent theology. So I felt like these are big things that I that there aren't good answers to and are fairly disruptive to the to Christian theology.
Yeah, and there's something about just letting them speak, you know, like, and just letting them hang themselves just by like, hey, why don't you tell me what you think? I mean, just tell me what's going on here, you know, because their story, like, we, you know, we sort of get hung up on like the minutiae of, you know, whether or not very, very specific things make sense. But it's like you start off talking about the fall, you know, one way or another, you have to fit that. If you're a Christian, you have to fit that into your narrative, like whether you think it's literally true or just a metaphor. God basically inspired this and, you know, wanted us to know this.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things early on, which just, I didn't understand. Why isn't this just a showstopper? I mean, the worldview, the theology was built on an event that never happened. Why is it continuing? And so that's where I put most of my energy in this book. It's just how it happened, because as I started looking into it, I'd find new books, and I really wanted to figure out how modern theologians are doing it. I mean, ones that are still trying to stay evangelical, still trying to keep the traditional theology together. Because, you know, on one hand, you know, the liberal theologians, they could care less about the fall. Like 100 years ago, that battle was fought. But if you ask me, I mean, I tried to track this down. I think they're so incompatible. They're just two different worldviews. I mean, the Genesis stories never anticipated what scientists would uncover, you know, thousands of years later. And it was just never, Christian theology was never built to handle evolution. So I just think it's so forced. But that would end up taking up more of my time than I thought, starting to look into ways that they are trying to smush these two worldviews together.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to something like the fall or evolution, like the original authors of the Bible clearly did not anticipate those things. And when, quote, sophisticated people try to come in and say, no, it's, you know, you're being too literalistic. That would be so silly of you to take it as the authors clearly intended it. You know, the authors, you know, the people who invented the religion just clearly had something in mind that just hasn't been borne out. And if you're a Christian, you know, you reach this fork in the road at one point where you either have to say, okay, I think science is a, you know, liberal hoax, or no, actually, now that I think of it, the book never said that in the first place. What are you, right, you know, some kind of unsophisticated literalist? You know, they either have to, and each position is kind of ridiculous for its own, you know, separate reasons. But, you know, I came from a family that took the option of basically just denying science, which honestly made a little bit more sense to me, because they're looking at this book and they're just saying, why would God lie? Why would God put something in here that just wasn't true? That's obviously what he meant. You know, this, right, is obviously what the authors intended, and why would he put something in his book that wasn't true? And that makes a lot more sense to me than what these liberal theologians are trying to push, even though they end up at the end of the day being, you know, better allies of science and progress generally. It's still, their story actually makes less sense to me.
Yeah, but a lot of these guys are still trying to stay conservative or orthodox in their theology. So they, and they take on the air of more sophistication. Oh, this isn't literal. This is, you know, we don't need to believe Adam lived to be 900 years old. And but what I found is at the same time, they're still hanging on to a historical fall. So while they want to sort of hand wave all the stuff that's blatantly ridiculous, they need the fall because it's just a very different story without the fall. I mean, because it's so connected to the reason Jesus came. So most of those theologians, the evangelicals that are mixing in evolution, are still trying to retain a historical Adam and Eve, which I thought was interesting. You know, I cover one guy, Dennis Lamoureux, who tries to get rid of Adam and Eve altogether. Said, you know what, this is ancient science. Adam and Eve weren't real. But the fact remains that we still die and we still sin, so we still have the same problem. And Jesus is the answer. But for most people, that's unacceptable because there are reasons why it's just, you can't just ditch the backstory, replace it, and keep the same punchline.
What's your opinion of the sophisticated apologists, like the Alvin Plantingas and the, you know, the Richard Swinburnes of the world?
Yeah, I didn't get into those guys as much because they're not really the ones doing as much work on the fall and evolution. I mean, you can say they're more sophisticated, but at the end of the day, it just feels like they're sophisticated in the sense that they're working so hard to keep the pieces together. But it just seems so contrived at the end of the day for me. It seems very forced and desperate.
Yeah, I'm sorry to break it to you guys, but your religion is not all that sophisticated. It doesn't require a sophisticated critique. You may think it needs one because it's so important to you and it's a centerpiece of our culture and it has such psychological and emotional significance to us. Like, it seems like such a big deal that you'd have to have a sophisticated critique of it. And I'm glad people are doing that because they should be answered, you know, but your religious beliefs look exactly as you'd expect if they were created by people who lived thousands of years ago and had the information that people had thousands of years ago.
That's the point I really tried to drive home. Is, yeah, you can go on these wild goose chases trying to make this make sense, but it, you know, if you drop the presupposition that it's an inspired book or an inerrant book, it makes complete sense. There's mm-hmm. There's no need to rationalize this stuff. This is the morality people had. These are the kind of primitive deities people believed in. They had no access to human origins. They could never. How would they ever know that there were billions of years and millions of extinctions in Neanderthals? That's why I still think the Bible is a young Earth creationist book. I think that is just, it's really hard to squeeze the overwhelming vast majority of Earth's history before Adam and Eve. I mean, I think it's pretty clear they're in the beginning. You know, I think at Genesis 2, it's even Adam was created before rain came upon the earth. You know, there's a lot of things like that. And you have the genealogies that really tie them to about 6,000 years ago. So it's not a crazy belief if you believe the Bible is the perfect word of God, that the earth is 6,000 years old.
Yeah, and I mean, they do things that you really wouldn't have known. Like, they created, like, there was water in the book before there were stars, which, you know, created the elements that you'd need to make water. Like, there's all kinds of weird, I think the earth was there before the sun. And it's just, you know, it's stuff you wouldn't have, you know, if you did, like you said, if you just drop the presupposition and stop trying to bend over backwards to make this make sense, it's like, oh, that's what they would think, you know?
Right.
And that's why, right, I like your title, because, you know, I'm sure you've gotten plenty of snarky atheists who are just like, oh, when did Christianity ever make sense? And it's like, well, it did make sense. I mean, you know,
it made much better sense than it does today.
Exactly. It made a lot more sense if you lived 500 years ago or 3,000 years ago. Well, I mean, it wasn't around back then, but
yeah,
you know, it did.
Or even 200 years ago, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you're coming up on, it would have been hard 200 years ago, I think, if you actually grappled with the full extent of human knowledge. Like, even 200 years ago, it still would have been hard.
No, yeah, definitely harder than 500 years ago, but still, if you look at the morality, you know, we're still a lot, we wouldn't run into conflicts with a lot of morality yet. Or, and people were still could countenance a more fearsome God, I think, 200 years ago.
Yeah, I hadn't thought Yahweh, wasn't Yahweh like originally a war God and like a pantheon of gods? And like, I remember reading somewhere that, I don't think it's controversial to say that the Jews were like henotheists, like they believed right. in many gods, but they worshiped Yahweh. And yeah. like a lot of the prophets in the Old Testament, they were saying like, we need to get back to worshiping Yahweh. And like the way we read that now is like, yeah, you were worshiping all these fake, you know, pagan gods, but if you read it in the context of the time, then you realize yeah. that they believed in many gods and they needed to return to this strong war god because they were getting kicked around too much. And that's why they had to go back to Yahweh.
Yeah. And again, if you don't have the presupposition, that does make sense that they believed other gods were real. They weren't supposed to worship them, but they were real.
So coming to, you spent a lot of time talking about mysteries in the book, like kind of, I don't know exactly how you'd want to frame it or how you'd want to put it, but the thing that seems to bother you the most is why there is something at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's insane that there's a universe and we exist. I mean, it boggles my mind. And, you know, that's the stuff that I couldn't take for granted when I was younger. And that's what drew me towards belief in God. And I would never became a Christian, by the way, but belief in God and just towards religion and wanting to look into it.
Well, wanting to look into religion because they actually acknowledge these questions in the first place.
Yeah. And I just thought that, you know, the universe screamed for an answer, you know, why is everything here? And at least, you know, I guess that's the domain of religion. At least the people that are worshiping God are not taking it for granted. And they're aware of this, the problem, I guess. And so I liked that. I thought because I grew up in a pretty secular scene. And so I kind of felt, you know, eventually I'll get over there because that seems to be what we should be doing.
I mean, I was brought up religious, but when I started to have doubts in like high school, I fully expected to come back to, I mean, you were mentioning my deconversion story earlier, I think before we started. And, you know, I fully expected to like have a come to Jesus moment. You know, like all these doubts I have will just, there's some, you know, somebody out there has the answers. Like there's some smart religious person out there who could totally just answer all these questions and doubts I have. And just, you know, like I fully expected to come back to religion, like come back to Christianity, because, you know, I thought you couldn't really make sense of the universe without appealing to some kind. I mean, now I would say appealing to magic because things are confusing, but to me, it's like, well, there has to be some kind of designer. I knew nothing about, it's arguable that I know nothing now about our understanding of physics, but I know a lot more than I knew, you know, 5 years ago. And I knew nothing about biology or, you know, I was fairly sheltered from all that stuff. I just fully expected to come back to it, but I really, really, you know, asked hard questions and didn't hold back because I was like, well, you know, if this is the truth, then there's no reason to hold back. Like it, sure. You know, if it's true, it'll seem more true after I ask all these questions. And that just never turned around. It just kept seeming less and less true. The more questions I asked, and people eventually just told me to have faith after they got tired of answering me.
So did you officially leave Christianity, your identity as a Christian in high school, or was that later?
It was like right after high school. I still believed in, the thing is, I still believed in God for like a solid year after I stopped being a Christian. Like, because I still thought you couldn't explain anything without a God. I mean, I basically just thought God was an asshole, like because I was just looking around and I was like, well, there has to be a God because you can't explain any of this without a God. But he's clearly not good. You know, he's just a dick. But I mean, there's totally a God. He's just an asshole God.
Yeah. And based on the Bible or based on just the suffering in the world?
The suffering in the world has never bothered me as much as other atheists, it seems, or even Christians seem very bothered by the suffering in the world. But I never really cared much for the problem of evil. It was more, I mean, just going back to the fall, for example, it's like God created us with the amount of intelligence that we have, and he created us with the natures that we have. You know, like if you think of God as like a constant, because if you're a Christian, you think he was here, you know, before us. So just take whatever, you know, measure of God's intelligence or power or whatever as the constant. And then he created us, you know, what fraction of God's intelligence do we have? Like 1/1000th, like 1/1 millionth, like maybe even less. So it's like, you know, God created these creatures that are just, you know, just stupid compared to him. Like, we just have no intelligence, like no power, no intelligence. And then he gets mad at us. He basically, I mean, our intelligence compared to God's is basically our intelligence compared to an infant's. And it's just like, if we created a bunch of infants, you know, and put all these really heavy demands on them and said we were going to set them on fire if they, you know, disappointed us in a certain way, we'd be lunatics. Well, I, you know, now that I think of it, it must have partially been the suffering. It's just tough because, you know, your memory of those times are just, there's right. like a temptation of like going back and like, oh, you know, I was always this skeptical kid. It's like, no, I really wasn't. I was really devoted to, you know, to my faith for most of my life. But I was just in this haze of contradictions for like almost a year where it's like, you know, maybe there's a God, but he's not a good God. And, you know, maybe I'm a Christian, but I don't accept God's invitation.
And I don't want to take over the questioning, but I'm curious, your family is still religious? Pretty much everybody around you?
Deeply. They actually don't even believe I'm an atheist. They, I'm sure many people listening to this can relate to that. They just think I'm in some kind of phase or I'm just denying it. Like, they think I still actually believe, but, am denying. It's been years since I told them I was an atheist, but, I think
you guys actively debate.
No, that's the thing is like, they could be disabused of this in 10 seconds if they would talk about it, but they refuse to talk about it, which is kind of odd because they, center their entire lives around it. They're all in ministry, but you're not, you didn't have any situation like that. You said you grew up in a really secular household.
Yeah. I'd say, you know, kind of spiritual, but not religious. And even socially, I can't really remember any friends that went to church. It just wasn't really an issue, which I thought was weird. Why isn't this an issue for everybody else? Isn't anyone curious? You know, but I guess, I think what you were getting at earlier is, why am I still in that position? Not quite comfortable with the word atheist. The truth is, I haven't spent much time even thinking about labels. I've spent time just looking at Christianity and saying, well, I don't think that makes sense. And I know there's debates that I haven't followed about the merits of the word agnostic versus atheism. And I don't really know what that debate looks like, but
you're not missing out on much.
Yeah. I'm not that interested in it, I guess, but I don't know. Let's see. I feel like just in common communication, atheism, if someone's an atheist, you think there's no God, right? And I still think it's likely there is. I just don't know, don't think it's a God that cares about being worshipped or even identified. You know, so let me back up. So I sort of operated as a theist for a long time, just sort of assuming, because that's what most people are, that that's true. And then sort of got pushed over to deism. And I was pretty happy landing on deism and staying there for a little while because I felt like, okay, this is good. This is consistent with the fact that there's suffering in the world and the universe is so indifferent. And it explains why there's something rather than nothing. This seems like a safe place to be. But it's a God that hasn't given us much. It's just, sort of natural theology.
Is that where you are right now, or have you moved a little bit past
that? Kind of, but I think the problem with deism that I eventually thought about was, you really have nothing to go on. Why are you even saying it's a God? Maybe it's gods. Maybe it's a simulation.
Well, not even that, but why is it a person? Like, why is it a conscious creature? Why, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why, like, that seems like a leap to, if you want to posit some kind of metaphysical baggage because you think it's necessary to explain something, you know, we can have a conversation about that. But what that metaphysical baggage is, you know, it doesn't have to be a conscious agent. Like, that's my problem with deism is that, you know, you're sort of using it as almost a placeholder for some ignorance somewhere. Like, I don't know how this thing happened, so it, you know, there must be some kind of deistic God. But putting aside the fact there's no positive evidence for that other than just sort of a God of the gaps, there's no reason it has to be a conscious being. It could just be, you know, something. It could just be, like I said, some kind of metaphysical baggage. It doesn't have to be a conscious creature.
Yeah. It's not anything I'd be dogmatic about, but it's just so unsatisfying to me to say something came from nothing. I just feel like there has to be...
Well, who says that?
Well, I don't know what the alternative is, I guess.
I mean, I don't think there ever was, like, truly nothing in the sense that our intuitions sort of define, like, you know, an absence of all, you know, space, time, matter, energy. Like, I don't think there ever was a time when there was, like, no energy, when there's truly no, like, nothing. Just absolutely nothing. Because I don't see how there would ever be something if there was ever truly nothing. So
problem.
I don't think there ever was a state of nothingness.
I don't know. I mean, it's nothingness is sort of a concept we can't even fathom. I mean, but I guess if there's always something, that still requires an explanation.
Yeah, I would say... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm just going to keep saying I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I mean, that's like half the fun. Like, that's what's great about not really being ideologically committed to anything is you can just go, ooh, that's interesting. And yeah. But the thing is, mysterious doesn't equal non-naturalistic. Like, I fully acknowledge the mysteries, but there's this one... I think it was Michael Martin's book. It was called Atheism, A Philosophical Justification. And in like the prologue, he was talking about his uncle who kind of, or somebody who, some family member who turned him on to like philosophy. And what his family member said was like, it's very hard to see how there could be an uncaused cause, but it is also very hard to see how a chain of causes could go on forever. Like, yeah. And that's what you're saying, where it's like, it's just either way, it's amazing.
I guess given all this, I would say that agnostic just feels like a better fit. And again, I haven't been through the debates, but...
Well, it just comes down to what you actually believe. Like, you can acknowledge all these things and still be an atheist. Like, there's nothing about atheism that says, and there are no mysteries, and, you know, everything is totally solved. It just means, you know, this totally incoherent concept that we're calling God, well, that's just, you know, there's no evidence for it, and I don't believe it. I think Bertrand Russell said if he's talking to like a lay audience, he's an atheist. And if he's talking to like a group of philosophy students, then he's an agnostic. Because the effect is just like, look, there's no God. Okay. But like, if we're going to actually talk about what we can justify, then yeah, no, you have to be agnostic about everything. Like in the same way, you know, you can't prove any, like you were mentioning a simulation earlier, you can't prove you're not in a simulation or we're not in the Matrix or we're not asleep and dreaming or something like that. Or we could be mistaken about every single detail about our, you know, existence. The only thing we can't be mistaken about is that we are having an experience. That's it. So everything else you have to be agnostic about. None of that really is a problem for being an atheism is just a null position on one question, which it sounds like you don't really affirm any sort of, it sounds like psychologically you don't really think there's a God.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's totally possible. Again, I think it's so weird that anything exists at all that I just could not count it out at all that there's some other intelligence beyond our reach that is responsible for this.
The thing is, you don't get out of that question by positing a God, because God is quite a something. You know, God is, he's made of some kind of God stuff, especially if he's thinking, you know, that's insane. That's not how consciousness works as best as we can tell. And it's just like, I don't see why would the default state be nothingness? Like I guess sort of inherent in the question of why is there something rather than nothing? You're sort of implying that, well, you know, we see all this somethingness and that's really weird. That's not at all what I expected. I would expect, it's like, wait, why is the default state nothing? Like, why would I don't think that's based on any reason or evidence, like why you would expect there to be nothing. And it's so surprising that there's something.
I think nothing needs no explanation. Nothing makes way more sense as the default. As soon as there's something, then you need an explanation. Nothing just doesn't seem to need an explanation.
But I'm talking about whether or not it would be like easier for there to be nothing or something. Like, somethingness does require some kind of explanation, but that doesn't really explain why it would be like easier physically for there to be nothing. Like, why would it be easier for things to be in that state? Do you think there are any just brute facts, though? Like, I think the somethingness is almost just a brute fact. Like, there has to be, because there's something right now, and, you know, we might not know anything about it, but there is something. And at some point, things bottom out just in a brute fact. There has to just be something because it just is. The thing is, you don't get out of that question by positing a God. So I'm saying, even if you want to posit a God, like whether a deistic God or a Christian God, you have to explain why the somethingness of God would be there. I mean, God is really, really not
totally
nothing.
It just, I know it pushes it back one step, but I still, and again, I'm not dogmatic on this, but that, like, magic is more satisfying to me than nothing. I mean, if it's just something that outside this realm that we cannot even fathom, I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. And I have no way of knowing. So I guess So in a way, I guess I haven't really had a deep conversation going back and forth on this, because at the end of the day, I just think it's so unknowable.
Well, any explanation would seem like magic to us, but the thing is, like, sort of mystical explanations are not really explanations. They, you know, they're kind of superficial, and they only appear to explain something, but they're not really explanations at all. It's just, I really, really am not okay with, like, abandoning rational principles to cave into my bias to have some kind of answer, just because it's extremely unsatisfying to me to just say, well, I don't know. I mean, saying, well, here's some magical thing I can't really explain, but, you know, I mean, that is actually less satisfying.
I guess I'm just saying more of an openness to there being something beyond on the other side of the curtain.
Yeah, that's I'm definitely open. I mean, that's what's, like I was saying, what's so great about being non-ideological is if you don't understand something, like in Christianity, like if you look at like the Trinity or something, and you're just like, hey, I don't understand how 3 = 1, you know, they're going to work with you until you at least pretend to get it or something, you know, because like this is the thing we have to think, you guys. Whereas like, you know, if you're an atheist or just a naturalist generally, then if something doesn't make sense, you can just, or, you know, something weird does make sense to you, then you can just throw it out there and then you can talk about it. It's not like, oh man, we gotta get Evan back into the materialist flock here. Like, no, it's like I have a total principle of openness towards pretty much anything, but it, you know, there has to be evidence for it. It has to make sense. There's nothing that's gained by positing a God. Like you're still just saying, well, there's this brute fact of existence with this God. Like he just exists. And also, you know, he's this conscious being and, you know, he has a gender already and like he has some very strong opinions about some things. Like that doesn't do anything. I mean, that requires a lot more of an explanation than just saying. And the thing is, there is no cosmological model that I'm aware of that actually teaches creation ex nihilo. There's not like, oh, there's nothingness and then somethingness sprang from it. You know, it appears that there's always been sort of a fact of existence. Lawrence Krauss wrote that book, Something from Nothing, or something like A Universe from Nothing. Mm-hmm. And he even said, I mean, people really trashed that book because they were just like, you don't believe that something came from nothing. You think there was always something. Like his whole shtick was just like, look, we've made progress since, you know, 2000 years ago. And the fact is, like, the philosopher's nothing or the theologian's nothing just isn't really a coherent concept physically. And there never was nothing in the sense that they mean. And he's like, oh, well, you know, empty space even has energy in it. And then he says, like, that's something coming from nothing. It's like, okay, but that's not what anyone means when they say, you know, something from nothing. There's still energy in empty space. And, you know, that's unstable and it, you know, inherently is going to give rise to something else. That's not what people mean. And again, positing a God doesn't get you out of this problem. You have to posit at least one brute fact.
Yeah, my brain hurts.
Well, hey, man, you're the one who's asking all the deep questions in your book. You know, we have to talk about it.
Yeah, no, I just don't. I think that's one where we just can't answer. I don't think science has access to that one. I mean, even, not to start the whole thing over again, but, you know, again, even if there's always something, why is there always something? You know, why was there always something instead of nothing?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where no matter what the answer is, it's going to be mind-blowing. And you can say, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. But the fact is, I mean, no matter what the answer is, it's going to be really confusing. But I'll just say one more, or I'll say two more really short things and we can move on. One is just that, you know, really mind-boggling or really mysterious doesn't equal non-naturalism. I fully acknowledge that these are, you know, questions that I don't know the answer to at all. But you know, it doesn't have to be an agent. It doesn't have to be some kind of magical thing. You know, there was a time when we didn't understand volcanoes, but that didn't justify some kind of non-naturalistic explanation. And it might just be an accident of history, the fact that we're talking about something like this now or the hard problem of consciousness. But the second thing, this is the last thing I say, and we can move on. But just sort of the notion of an uncaused cause that occurred to me, like sort of at the beginning of this conversation, is just, it's sort of based on an intuitive but outdated conception of physics, like an Aristotelian conception of physics that we know is wrong. Like I think Sean Carroll said in his debate with William Lane Craig, like this Aristotelian analysis of causation was cutting edge stuff 2,500 years ago. It's fully based on our intuitions, and we know that it's not correct. Or the reason we even want to ask the question of an uncaused cause is just totally based on an intuitive conception of physics that is incorrect. Our intuitions evolve to help us understand, you know, social situations and to survive in this kind of like macroscopic world where like Newtonian physics applies. And our intuitions are great for Newtonian physics. Like there's nothing really that we learned from Newtonian physics that was like, well, that's just totally counterintuitive. I can't accept that. But as soon as we get to, you know, like general relativity or quantum mechanics, we get to things that are just totally at odds with our intuitions, which is exactly what you would expect. I mean, you wouldn't expect our intuitions to be any good when it comes to questions of like fundamental physics. And the whole notion of an uncaused cause is based on a notion of physics that is demonstrably untrue.
I guess I'd say when debating Christians, this is an arena I go to. I feel like it's a tricky one mm-hmm. with a theist. I just feel like there's, which maybe you agree with this, but a lot of times when we have these science versus Christianity debates, it ends up here and it just kind of goes nowhere. I guess that's back to what we were talking about earlier. I think even this something rather than nothing does not even get you close to Christianity. And I think there's like I said, such low-hanging fruit where you don't even have to go to this place to debate. I mean, it's an interesting debate just in general. But as far as Christianity, which is what most people are arguing for, there's so many bigger problems that are specific to Christianity.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to... I don't think I'd go to why is there something rather than nothing to debate with a Christian, but just as
it's interesting, but it's like functionally for me, how I live, it's not going to impact, even if if I'm open to some deity creating everything functionally, how I live my life, it doesn't have much impact at all. Hmm. You know, there wouldn't be any space between me and an atheist when it comes to day-to-day living.
So part of your resistance to atheism, though, is you say you just want to leave the door open to anything, but there's nothing really about, you know, just saying, oh, I don't believe in God, that means, you know, I don't believe in God and I'll never believe in God, no matter what the evidence or arguments. Like, you just don't believe in God.
Yeah. And maybe it's, like I said, maybe it's just definitional. And if I spent more time, then I'd just embrace the term. I guess when I hadn't really been exposed to it, I just figured these people, they must know what they're talking about. It's everywhere. Mm. There's churches and, you know, priests and pastors. They must know. They have the inside info. Again, sounds weird now, but
no.
Did assume that they must have it figured out. You know, I never understood that Christianity was something you had to sign up for and you had to be saved from eternal punishment. Once I started looking into it, that was like the big shocker. What? Really? Because I feel like Christianity has such a nice, wholesome reputation in America. Once you factor in what hell and the actual worldview, it's just, I mean, I don't know how to soft pedal. It's horrendous. And it's not a nice worldview. So
no,
I guess
it's absolutely immoral doctrine. And then the only thing they really have, like, I mean, I don't want to launch into a whole like moral conversation here, but you know, they want to pretend that they're like the moral lighthouses of the country, and like we wouldn't even know right from wrong if it weren't for, you know, the Christian leaders in our society. I'm so sick of that attitude. Like, especially just moving forward into like new ethical areas, like where we're sort of in uncharted territory right now in terms of like what do we do with the situation that's on our hands in a million different areas, like whether it's like science or politics. And it's just like the idea that we're still asking these people, like, what should we do is just mind boggling to me, because like, I don't mind, you know, like if I'm talking to Christians and it's like, we can have a fun debate and everything, and I'm trying to convince them and they're trying to convince me. And it's just 'cause I'm interested in, you know, science and philosophy. And this is just sort of like a fun little outlet for it, you know, arguing about religion, because it was our first attempt at philosophy and religion. It's like a primitive form of philosophy. You know, then you start looking in the real world and it's like, we're still asking these people what to do about, you know, gene editing. And it's like, do we really want to live in a world where we're asking people who take Christianity seriously, like what to do about gene editing or what to do about any of the ethical issues that face us? And that, it stops seeming like such a fun, you know, little game to me at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, like you said, the moral argument, it's kind of insane how prevalent the moral argument is. Every turn comes up. And it's sort of used, the utility of it, I feel like, is to sort of cut you off at the knees to not allow you to criticize the slavery in the Bible or punishing people for eternity. On what standard are you saying that slavery is wrong? Who are you to criticize our religion?
Exactly.
So it seems sort of disingenuous. It's more like a tool to sort of to throw the conversation off and protect some of their more heinous views.
Yeah. And they don't believe what they're saying. I mean, they're just trying to win an argument at that point because, you know, they look through the Bible and they see all the horrific stuff of, like, you know, stone a woman who's suspected of being a non-virgin, like in front of her dad on her wedding night. And it's like, you know, or like you mentioned the slavery, like I just mentioned in the last episode, how there's this like golden calf story, which is like a well-known story where it's like, some people are, you know, they have a different religion and then they just slaughter them for worshiping, you know, a different God. And then just for good measure, God strikes them with a plague. It's not like they're stupid. I mean, they can see that that's bad, but, you know, in order to win the argument, they have to go to a weird place and basically detach from how they actually live their life. Because they're the ones who are going through the Bible and picking and choosing and saying, well, this you have to look at in context. But when they look at things that are good, you know, suddenly they don't care too much about the context anymore or about, you know, the moral argument because it's in line with our moral intuitions, which we share for the most part.
Yeah, it's confusing how Christianity is held in such high regard and the Bible is so respected when it does have so many blatant bad things in it. Now, a lot of that is because many Christians don't believe that stuff and many of them don't even know it's there. Many people don't even know their own theology. Here's an example, like when Trump opened the new embassy in Jerusalem and it was Robert Jeffress and who's that other end times guy, John Hagee, showed up, these two Christian pastors, to give speeches. And everyone's shocked. These extremists who believe that, you know, Mormons are going to hell and Jews are going to hell, these extreme, you know, it's not.
Oh, my God.
It's them. It's not. Christianity, you know, it's like Christianity gets a pass and it's just these crazy guys. But that's what I think in mainstream society, people are so unaware of what the theology actually is. I mean, it's one belief changes many of your other beliefs. You take the Bible as the word of God and many things follow from that if you truly take it seriously. And I don't get people who kind of halfway take it seriously. I think it's a slippery slope once the Bible is unreliable in some parts and not others.
So
I don't know. I'm wondering, how about when you left, did you go in phases? Because I would think it would be hard. Something you've based your entire life around and your family has based their lives upon this. It can't be just the whole enterprise can't be made up and man-made and total BS. I would think you kind of go in phases. It seemed like most people say, well, whole thing obviously can't be bunk. But, you know, some things are wrong and it's a gradual slide.
It was just, you know, it was just little things, you know, weren't making sense. Like, I remember the last year or so when I still was like a Christian and, you know, I stopped praying because I was like, prayer doesn't do anything. Like, this doesn't do anything. It was just a slow transition of just one little thing at a time. And then 6 months go by and you realize that you've sort of, you know, you don't believe like 10% of what you did believe a few months ago. And then it just kept going and going like that until, you know, family members started noticing that I was like saying kind of snarky things about the Bible and about God. And I remember one of the first major hangups, like not sort of about, well, is this true? But like morally, it was the same thing that a million people see, which is just the slavery. It's like, this is such a basic question. Like, can we own other people as property? And, you know, the usual apologetic is something like, well, biblical slavery is different from, you know, it's like, is it the kind of slavery where you own a person? Because, like, that's what makes it wrong. Like, it's when you own a human as property. And it's like, the fact that God missed that one is just not really possible to believe.
Yeah. And the fact that it makes perfect sense that it's in there because it was written by ancient people who had no idea slavery was wrong.
You know, just briefly, you had a whole chapter on hell. That hell, the idea of hell is just absurd on a number of grounds. But again, a lot of them are sort of moral objections. It's like, you know, how does a finite crime merit an infinite punishment? Why can't you get out of hell after you already go there? Why does it have to be infinite? Why are there only two places, you know, rather than multiple places? Like, why can't we just stop existing? Why didn't, like, you could just go on and on about, like, well, you know, why didn't God make it clearer to us that hell existed? Or, you know, maybe like the criteria for going there. And then, like, it's like, well, the criteria that they try to try to give that, you know, divides people into these two places is just kind of, it's like, no, it's, you know, it's what you believe. Like, do you believe the right set of propositions? That's an insane criterion.
It really is. I mean, it's based on coming across a particular story and believing it's true. And that's how you avoid being punished for eternity.
Yeah. Were you credulous enough?
And that's one thing where I really wanted to shine a light on hell, because it's so demented and I don't know why it gets such a pass. I mean, I don't think people really know what they're signing up for. It's just about the worst thing you could think of. And so I really tried not to pull punches. I don't think there's any way to talk about it honestly and soft pedal it. I mean, there's no way around it. We're not talking about Hitler. We're talking about ordinary people, family members, your neighbor goes off into eternal punishment forever and ever. It's really, really dark stuff and really a depressing chapter to write. I also tried to look at how illogical it is. Like, all these questions come up, like, do babies go to hell? It's a disgusting question, but unfortunately, this was a real question through the centuries in Christianity. And it does naturally spring from the doctrine. If every single person is deserving of hell because they're fallen and they have the sin nature, you know, when does that kick in? I mean, it's a real question, unfortunately.
And people try to get around that. Like, they point to, because that was actually a question, that was one of the questions I had, like, at the sort of the beginning of my, you know, descent into non-belief was, you know, what about babies? I think I was like 17 or so when I was asking this question, and I got different answers from different people in the church. Like, one of them said, yeah, absolutely, they go to hell. And and another one was like, no, of course not. And they referenced the story of David. I guess he had a baby who died, and he was like, oh, I'll see it again someday. And then they cling to that. And but the thing is, it really could go either way. And they try to get out of it with something like the age of accountability, which has a few different. But that opens up a whole different can of worms, which is just, okay, so either babies go to hell, which is awful, or babies don't go to hell and they go straight to heaven. It's like, okay, well, why not kill your babies then? I mean,
why risk it, man?
Why risk it, man? I mean, you're born on planet Earth. There's like an 80% chance that you're not going to heaven. And, you know, eternity is eternity. Yeah. Like, you know, it's 80 years here. I mean, Christians, put your money where your mouth is. Go drown your infants in the bathtub if you really believe.
Or celebrate abortion. I mean, that sounds really bad, but if that's true, your worldview, that these people will not have to risk being punished for not a trillion years, but eternity. And even if you do stick with the age of accountability, that's such an awkward concept. It, for some reason, the people like to say it's around 12 years old. I'm not sure why, but just the fact that there is some precise moment in everyone's life where once you cross that and you have not come upon the proper worldview, you'll be punished for eternity. But if you die 1 second before that, you have eternal bliss.
And I mean, if the age of accountability is correct, then you don't even have to just go on an abortion spree to save those souls. Like, you can just go around massacring kids. Like, there's just no, that is a logical implication of the worldview, that there is no reason to be sad about dead kids or dead infants or abortion. And honestly, it would be very compassionate of you to just go on an abortion spree, like, just because they're going straight to heaven, and, you know, they don't have to deal with a gauntlet here on earth, and they also don't have to risk going to hell, which, according to most versions of Christianity, most people are going to hell. Like, just the odds are you're going to hell. Those are just the way things were set up. And it's like, if aborted kids go to hell, that's unjust. But if they go to heaven, well, then what is your problem with abortion exactly?
Yeah. Rob Bell actually even brought that up in his book, Love Wins, when he sort of got excommunicated from the evangelical ranks.
Yeah, Rob Bell is a weird character. Have you looked into him very much?
Not very much. I mean, I read Love Wins, and I've heard him on some interviews, and I can't tell exactly what he believes. It's really not clear. You know, it's interesting. I think hell has become so, thankfully, so unpalatable today to most Christians that honestly, the biggest defense I hear is, well, who am I to say who gets in? It's sort of it's so unpalatable that the defense is like, well, maybe we're wrong. Maybe the doctrine's wrong. That's the defense. it's hardly a defense. It's just sort of avoiding an embarrassing situation.
Well, you've already been very generous with your time. Thank you for writing Christianity No Longer Makes Sense. Everyone should go buy that on Amazon, where it is available. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks for doing the podcast. I'm a fan.
That's all I have for you today. Thanks to Evan for coming on. You can find the links to his website and his book in the show notes. I have a new patron to thank this week, Paul Patton. Thank you, Mr. Paul Patton. And of course, thank you to my Hall of Fame patrons, Peach Machine, Jesta, and Phil Stillwell. And you can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to disappoint your parents, you can like us on Facebook, leave a 5-star review, or tell your friends about the podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.